This is study number 13
in our camp meeting in Australia 1990.
So let us see now how there is a war between the king of the north and God's people, and how God's people are tempted to escape this war and thereby give entrance to the king of the north into their midst. We turn again now to page 402 in the book Acts of the Apostles. We have seen how the leaders in Jerusalem were very much enlightened now about the true labors of Paul. They saw that God was with them and that they, in their efforts to please the Jews, had really not helped the work but hindered the work. Now this reminds me a little bit of the works that Paul did concerning the slaves. Now Paul's thoughts on slavery were very clear, weren't they? Today our thoughts on slavery are clear, aren't we? We are against slavery, or is somebody here for slavery? Nobody. So that is absolutely clear. Slavery is wrong. But there was slavery in the time of Paul. Do you find in the letters of Paul a campaign against slavery? Really not? Not an obvious campaign against slavery, but there was a campaign against slavery which was much deeper than just a campaign. He preached the gospel, and this cut at the root of slavery, didn't it? That is what I mean. Now, in other words, Paul confined himself to the message that God had given to him, and this made his work successful. Had Paul endeavored to root out slavery by writing a campaign against slavery, would he have succeeded? Not at all. But Paul really knew that there's only one way to make people free, and that was the gospel. And this he preached. Now, likewise, the leaders in Jerusalem, they should have seen very clearly that their efforts to evade controversy were not leading to anything, but the work of the gospel that Paul did was the only work that was really winning souls. Anything else was not winning souls. And this, in the moment, they could see, and it was a golden opportunity for them. So we read on page 403, "This was the golden opportunity for the leading brethren to confess frankly that God had wrought through Paul, and that at times they had erred in permitting the reports of his enemies to arouse their jealousy and prejudice. But instead of uniting in an effort to do justice to the one who had been injured, they gave him counsel which showed that they still cherished a feeling that Paul should be held largely responsible for the existing prejudice. They did not stand nobly in his defense, endeavoring to show the disaffected ones where they were wrong, but sought to effect a compromise by counseling him to pursue a course which, in their opinion, would remove all cause for misapprehension." So they were saying, now Paul, we want really to save this brethren, these former brethren of the former church. And also, there are a few amongst us who cannot understand your work, and we want to save them too. So please do this one thing. Go into the temple and go and perform this rite, and then they all will see that you are an obedient boy, obedient man, who obeys the law that God gave through Moses. Now, why the brethren gave this counsel is more clearly said in page 404 in Acts of the Apostles. The brethren hoped that Paul, by following the course suggested, might give a decisive contradiction to the false reports concerning him. They assured him that the decision of the former council concerning the Gentile converts and the ceremonial law still held good. But the advice now given was not consistent with that decision. The Spirit of God did not prompt this instruction, but who prompted this instruction? Not the Spirit of God, but it was the fruit of cowardice. In other words, it was the fruit of trying to avoid the battle against the King of the North. And we must appreciate and understand that the battle of the that the battle against the King of the North is nothing pleasing to the human nature. And it is a great temptation for all Christians, even for us today, to avoid this battle, if possible. It is a great temptation. Now, if we don't understand this, we will soon fall into this temptation. We must understand the tactics of Satan. We must clearly understand that he is working with all possible means, making us feel bad at times. So the Spirit of God did not prompt this instruction. It was the fruit of cowardice. The leaders of the church in Jerusalem knew that by nonconformity to the ceremonial law, Christians would bring upon themselves the hatred of the Jews and expose themselves to persecution. So they understood very well that this preaching of Paul was not lessening the war against the King of the North, but was making it greater and hotter. It was making it more deadly, in fact. They understood this very well. So the Sanhedrin was doing its utmost to hinder the progress of the gospel. Men were chosen by this body to follow up the apostles, especially Paul, and in every possible way to oppose their work. Should the believers in Christ be condemned, the Sanhedrin, as breakers of the law, they would suffer swift and severe punishment as apostles from the Jewish faith. Many of the Jews who had accepted the gospel still cherished a regard for the ceremonial law and were only too willing to make unwise concessions, hoping thus to gain the confidence of their countrymen to remove their prejudice and to win them to faith in Christ as the world's Redeemer. You see, it's a great temptation to make a small compromise in order to win those whom we love. But we cannot. We must follow the implicit step, or we must implicitly follow the steps of the Redeemer. We must go his way. That's the only way we can be a help. Let us emphasize this again and again. Now, another text comes into my mind at the moment that shows us very clearly that there is inevitably a war against the King of the North. And this we find in Matthew chapter 10. Let's open this chapter for a moment. And we begin to read verse 34 and following. Until you open it, I will look for another scripture. Sorry, it takes me a little time to find it, but I have it soon. Okay, let's read now. Matthew 10, verse 34. Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it. No doubt, some of the leaders in Jerusalem, they even had relatives still in the Jewish faith, and they very dearly hoped to save them. And they thought, with Paul preaching like this, we can never save them. We must stop Paul doing that. We must do something else. But in this day, very much overlooked what Jesus said when he said, do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but the sword. Now that does not mean that we give up those with whom we are in a deadly war. Some of them, even though we battle at the moment against them, will still be won. But if we try to avoid the war in order to win them, we will certainly lose them. That is sure. But if we continue the war under the direction of Christ by not stopping to build God's kingdom God's way, we will be able to win them. Maybe I expressed myself not properly now. In other words, if you don't avoid the law, but instead of this, build God's kingdom God's way, by this making the war even hotter, we have a chance to win. some of the camp of the King of the North. Another text that is very interesting is Luke 12. There Christ says this in verse 49 and following. I came to send fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. But I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how distressed I am till it is accomplished. That was verse 49 and following. Luke 12:49 and following. Again, it was a distress even for Christ to enter into this battle, so don't be disappointed when it's a distress for us as well. But I have been a baptism to be baptized with, and how distressed I am till it is accomplished. Do you suppose that I came to give peace on earth? I tell you, not at all, but rather division. For from now on, five in one house will be divided, three against two and two against three. Father will be divided against son and son against father, mother against daughter and daughter against mother, and mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law and daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. What words are these? Now, I have often felt a little bit awkward when I gave the gospel to people and they accepted it, and then they got in great, great conflict with their relatives. So happened very lately with the new believers near our place. They have relatives with whom they always had a wonderful relationship. They understood very well from childhood on. And now the gospel came and suddenly they find themselves to be very strange with each other. Very strange. In fact, those who reject the gospel, they become very hateful and so forth. And our believers, they wonder what happened. And I somehow felt as though I was the cause for all these things because I brought the gospel to them. But then it should not surprise us. It is absolutely normal. That is what Jesus said. I am not come to bring peace, but I came to bring the sword. And in no way can we avoid this war against the King of the North. Now that it is a great temptation, we see now here in the leaders of Jerusalem. Let's turn to the story again on page 405. Many of the Jews who had accepted the gospel still cherished a regard for the ceremonial law and were only too willing to make unwise concessions, hoping thus to gain the confidence of their countrymen, to remove their prejudice and to win them to faith in Christ as the world's Redeemer. Paul realized that so long as many of the leading members of the church at Jerusalem should continue to cherish prejudice against him, they would work constantly to counteract his influence. He felt that if by any reasonable concession he could win them to the truth, he would remove a great obstacle to the success of the gospel in other places. Now look at Paul. What had he become? He felt that if by any reasonable concession he could win them to the truth, he would remove a great obstacle to the success of the gospel in other places. Now these thoughts in themselves are not wrong. If we can make a reasonable concession, we should make it. In other words, if there is a possibility of making a concession towards other people without being in any way disobedient to God, that's quite proper to do it. Paul did it quite often. He took upon himself quite some unnecessary hardships, you may say, because of the prejudice of others. But when it concerns our obedience to Christ, then it is absolutely essential that not by hair's breadth we make any concession. Now this thought of making a reasonable concession in order to win the others, in other words, this thought of going just one step in order to come near to the others and win them if possible, that was the mistake. It was really making himself the King of the North. Because the King of the North tries to build God's kingdom how? Man's way, not God's way. Now if in any way, even in the least way, we become disobedient to Christ, then we begin to build God's kingdom man's way. So there must be an absolutely uncompromising position concerning our obedience to God and all our religious duties. absolutely uncompromising position. All our religious duties, remember this. In other words, everything that concerns our duty towards Christ. Now, how easily do we make concessions? We say, well, let's do only this one thing, this one time. It's not so bad, and we will win him or her. But certainly we will not. Paul did not. It says then, but he was not authorized. Paul was not authorized of God to concede as much as they asked. Now this is a sad fact, that God's people again and again concede to the demands of the king of the north in order to win him. But this will never work. It did not work in the case of Paul, nor does it work today, nor does it work ever. Of course, it's understandable on the side of Paul, but yet it is a wrong act, and it is actually an act that made him the king of the north. Now, the king of the north had really entered into the glorious land. And as he did back there, he will try today, as we read in Daniel 11 verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land, and many shall fall. So many shall be deceived by this kind of tactics. They will try to make any reasonable concession, and there they will lose their strict obedience, and then, instead of winning their brethren, they will introduce the king of the north into the camp. Let's read now on page 405. When we think of Paul's great desire to be in harmony with his brethren, his tenderness toward the weak in the faith, his reverence for the apostles who had been with Christ and for James, the brother of the Lord, and his purpose to become all things to all men, so far as he could without sacrificing principle, when we think of all this, it is less surprising that he was constrained to deviate the firm, decided course that he had hitherto followed. But instead of accomplishing the desired object, what did he desire to accomplish? To win his brethren, exactly. But instead of accomplishing the desired object, his efforts for conciliation only precipitated the crisis, hastened his predicted sufferings, and resulted in separating him from his brethren, depriving the church of one of its strongest pillars, and bringing sorrow to Christian hearts in every land. So as it has been back there, so it will always be. When we in any way try to avoid the war and deviate from the strict path of principle, then we can be absolutely sure that we will not win, but lose. Instead of gaining our accomplishment, we will lose it. Now that seems very hard, what we study here. It seems that we really make now a war, start a war. But we must understand we have no other choice, have we? Do we? We have no other choice. We really must understand this. And it's not said in hatred or in stubbornness, what we say here, but it's said in great love. We bring forth these principles to make us understand that only a strict way of obedience can make us light bearers in this world. Nothing else. And this is seen very clearly in the case of Paul. Let us now come to the last pages of this chapter. On page 416 in the same book, Acts of the Apostles, few realize the full meaning of the words that Christ spoke when in the synagogue at Nazareth he announced himself as the Anointed One. He declared his mission to comfort, bless, and save the sorrowing of the sinful. And then, seeing that pride and unbelief controlled the hearts of his hearers, he reminded them that in time past God had turned away from his chosen people because of their unbelief and rebellion, and had manifested himself to those in heathen lands who had not rejected the light of heaven. The widow of Zarephath and Naaman the Syrian had lived up to all the light they had. Hence they were accounted more righteous than God's chosen people who had backslidden from him and had sacrificed principle to convenience and worldly honor. Few realized the full meaning of the words that Christ spoke. Now, when Christ said that the heathen would accept the gospel more than his own countrymen, he said something which is repeated again and again. In fact, we will find that what Christ said, that he makes a sword, that he brings a sword even into families, will become very true. Which means that we should not be surprised when, even in our own families, this enmity comes up, this war begins to start. And then we tend to think, well, but the ones that I love, they are certainly better than all the worldlings who reject the truth openly. And so we tend to see them in a better light, in a different light than all the others. And this, in a way, makes us more willing to compromise, to go, as we think, the second mile. But in the realm of our obedience to Christ, there's no second mile to go, is there? That would be really to go the contrary mile instead of the second mile. It would mean to lose them instead to win them. Now we must really realize what Christ said in the synagogue of Nazareth when he said, a prophet counts nothing in his own home. It is very true that it is very difficult in the own home to be a prophet. On the other hand, of course, we must not become discouraged through it. That is the reason why we study it. It is not that we say that now, forever, those people who do not accept the message at the beginning are lost. What we say is that there's a war, and this war we cannot escape. And even though there's a war, it still may lead to the salvation of some. Let's read now on page 417. Christ told the Jews at Nazareth a fearful truth when he declared that with backsliding Israel there was no safety for the faithful messenger of God. They would not know his worth or appreciate his labors. While the Jewish leaders professed to have great zeal for the honor of God and the good of Israel, they were enemies of both. By precept and example, they were leading the people further and further from obedience to God, leading them where he could not be their defense in the day of trouble. That was the case of the people of Nazareth, the Jews. But the Savior's words of reproof to the men of Nazareth applied in the case of Paul not only to the unbelieving Jews, but to his own brethren in the faith. Had the leaders in the church fully surrendered their feelings of bitterness toward the apostle and accepted him as one specially called of God to bear the gospel to the Gentiles, the Lord would have spared him to them. God had not ordained that Paul's labors should so soon end, but he did not work a miracle to conduct the train of counteract the train of circumstances to which the course of the leaders in the church at Jerusalem had given rise. So the King of the North comes very near, this we must realize, very, very near. And the nearest way he can get is into our own hearts. And the nearer he comes, the more he is to be feared. In other words, the papacy, even though today it is a power that is not persecuting us directly, will become a power that is to be feared. But much more those who actually are called brethren and yet build God's kingdom man's way, or try to build God's kingdom man's way. And much more than this is to be feared still, the King of the North in our own hearts. So the nearer the King of the North is, the more he needs to be feared. And he endeavors to come as near as possible. He wants to establish himself in the very nucleus, in the very heart of God's kingdom. The same spirit is still leading to the same results. A neglect to appreciate and improve the provisions of divine grace has deprived the church of many a blessing. How often would the Lord have prolonged the work of some faithful minister had his labors been appreciated. But if the church permits the enmity or the enemy of souls to pervert their understanding so that they misrepresent and misinterpret the words and acts of the servant of Christ, if they allow themselves to stand in the way and hinder his usefulness, the Lord sometimes removes from them the blessing which he gave. Satan is constantly working through his agents to dishearten and destroy those whom God has chosen to accomplish a great and good work. They may be ready to sacrifice even life itself for the advancement of the cause of Christ. Yet the great deceiver will suggest to their brethren doubts concerning them which, if entertained, would undermine confidence in their integrity of character and thus cripple their usefulness. In other words, if we see a war raging between one of our brethren and the King of the North, and we at the moment have nothing to do with it, it's possible, isn't it? There's a war between, let's say, some relatives of a person and himself, and then we look on, and we tend to think automatically, well, if there's a war, both parties must be guilty, isn't it? That's what we automatically tend to think. But is this so? It is not. Of course, it can be if the King of the North is still in the heart of the believer, and if he would fight with the means of the King of the North. That is possible. But provided it is a war on the principles of faith, then we can be very sure that it is not the fault of both parties. But it's a natural outcome, a very unavoidable outcome of the battle between the King of the North and God's people. So we must not entertain the idea in any way that this battle is because our brother was a little bit too strict on principles. We must be very careful with such thoughts, because in such a way we weaken the hands of God's workers. We must rather encourage each other in the knowledge that this fire is not strange. It is normal. It has happened to the believers in the past. Christ has clearly foretold this to his disciples. Therefore, let's be encouraged that these things are normal. And let's count ourselves blessed because we are in such a battle. Because then we know that we are on the right side. Let's not weaken the hands of God's workers in no way. That's very important. They may be ready to sacrifice even life itself for the advancement of the cause of Christ. Yet, the great deceiver will suggest to their brethren doubts concerning them which, if entertained, would undermine confidence in their integrity of character and thus cripple their usefulness. Too often he succeeds in bringing upon them through their own brethren such sorrow of heart that God graciously interposes to give his persecuted servants rest. In other words, if there's a battle, a war between the King of the North and some of God's servants, and we weaken him, how depressing, how discouraging must this be for God's servant. If he tried to give him counsel, oh yes, you must not be so strict. You must give way at times. That would be a great sin, wouldn't it? It really would weaken the hands of God's workers. Never let us allow to make such a thing. Rather, let's clearly understand what the issues are. After the hands are folded upon the pastor's breast, when the voice of warning and encouragement is silent, then the obdurate may be aroused to see and prize the blessing they had cast from them. Their death may accomplish that which their life has failed to do. So, we also, after we have watched this battle, may come in the same situation. And very soon we come. Because Jesus had made this point very clear. And let us see, if this battle was not there, then something would be wrong. Because it's clearly foretold. So let us now come back again to the principle that the only thing we have to give to the world in order to help them is the gospel. Even if it brings forth war, it's the only thing, nothing else. And since you asked before of the rich man and Lazarus, let's look at this story for a moment. And for this I turn to the book, Christ's Object Lesson. Under the headline, A Great Gulf Fixed, we find a very wonderful commentary about this. Now the whole story, to tell it quickly, is that there was a rich man and a poor man. The poor man was called Lazarus, and he was sick and poor, and the rich man, he was very hard-hearted. Even though he did not pull him away, yet he didn't give him from his means. There was a certain rich man, Christ said, which was clothed in purple and fine linen, and fared sumptuously every day. And there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, which was laid at the gate, full of sores, and desiring to be fed with the crumbs which fell from the rich man's table. Well, the rich man did not, as I said, throw him out, but he did not give him either. When both died, it was found that the rich man was in the torment of hell, where he suffered terribly, while the poor man was in Abraham's bosom. Was this so? Bosom, you say. Okay. And the rich man said to Abraham, yeah, Father Abraham, please go to my brethren. I have 5 brethren in my house, and tell them. And what did Abraham say? He said, let them listen to the gospel. That is the only thing that can help them. Now the whole point of the story is that we have nothing to give to the people but the gospel. Of course, it also talks of the sin of acquiring means and not giving it for the purpose of the gospel. But at the same time, it talks very clearly that it is impossible to give any other means to the poor, lost souls than the gospel. Now, in other words, if a dead would be resurrected and go to these people, they wouldn't listen. If they don't listen to the gospel that was given them firsthand, neither would they listen to a dead if he would be resurrected. But the demands of the unbelievers is always, give us something else. Give us something else, please. But if he would give them this something else instead of the gospel, would we help them? We wouldn't. We just couldn't. And this is what Abraham clearly said to the rich man. He said, even if a dead should be resurrected, they would not help them. Oh, sorry, I didn't know that you were talking to this. But anyway, I was thinking of this story, and it is very interesting too to see in the story of the rich man and Lazarus how the only way we can help people is by giving them that what the Lord has given to us and not giving them something else. In other words, there's only one way of healing from spiritual and physical diseases, and this is the way that the Lord has approved. Now the other story, or the other injunctions, that we shall help the poor, of course there's also in Isaiah 55 and so forth, 58, thank you, they have their validity, but how can we really, I forget the word now, minister to these needs, how can we really? That's right. The effectual way, that is what we have learned, is to minister to them the gospel. Now that's the same situation as in Paul's time when there was slavery. They were the poor slaves and they were the cruel masters. It was a terrible situation, unbearable for Christianity, you could say. But Paul never, ever taught against slavery directly. In fact, when a slave was coming running to him, he sent him back to his master. He said, go to your master, and he sent a letter with him. And so Paul was working in a way that he was commanded by God. In other words, God gave him the gospel. He gave him the cross. And he said, I knew nothing amongst you but Jesus and him crucified. Nothing. And when Paul was faithful to this ministry, he was effectually undermining the cause for slavery. And eventually, slavery was abolished, wasn't it? Today we have no slavery. And why? Only because of the gospel. It's not because men is more enlightened today than they were past there. It's because of the gospel. It's an effect of the gospel. And so likewise, we have many poor people in the world. And what is the effective way to help these poor people? Is it to spend all our means to feed them? Or is it to bring them the gospel? That is the question we must see very clearly is answered by God, that we must know nothing else in the world but Christ and Him crucified. It's all the same principle. As I said, there are many statements to this effect that we shall help the poor. And, of course, I would say if the Lord brings us directly under His personal guidance to a poor person, then we must not deny to give him from our means, also physical. But, generally speaking, our work is for the spiritual needs, and if these are fulfilled, then the people, or then poverty is effectively worked against. And when Jesus said, I was there and you gave me a cup of cold water and so forth, he was really referring to the fact that our work is to undermine poverty with the power of the gospel, not with the power of money. That is not our means. Our means is the power of the gospel. Yeah, provided the Lord directs us, isn't it?
Oh yes, you don't go around trying to, yeah, under God's guide, under the direction of the Lord.
Yeah, okay. Well, the great point is, we must understand that it is the way of the King of the North today to feed the poor with material means. Thereby he tries to build God's kingdom. That is the way of the Catholic Church, of the Protestant churches, of everybody. And he makes us feel bad if we do not do the same thing. If the poor are coming and for the moment we give them nothing because the Lord has not given us direction and we have only the gospel for them, then we feel very bad, isn't it? And Satan then shows through his agents with fingers on us and shows us, you are unloving, you are not on the sides of the gospel. Well, this is the way of the King of the North. Again, let us emphasize this. The way of the King of the North tries to prove that he is a better or a superior person by giving material means. Now, we cannot give proof in this way. The way we can give proof that we are on the right side is only if we have the power of the gospel that does not change us only in giving from material means, but makes us free from sin and makes the other people free from sin and from sickness and from unrest of mind. This is what we need today. Yeah, but primarily our work is to give the gospel. That really needs to be emphasized. And what I want to show in this study, or wanted to show, is that Satan is appealing to our mercy, He's appealing to our mercy in order to lead us on his path. But we must be very careful, understanding that between us and the King of the North, there can be no similarity. It's impossible. But we have to close, sorry. We continue the subject tonight, shall we?